Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments you can hear Joan Knows. Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, brings us the Vatican Week in review. But first we join Jill Bevilacqua, who presents this week's edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye.
Pilate called together the chief priests, the ruling class, and the people, and said to them, "You have brought this man before me as one who subverts the people. I have examined him in your presence, and have no charge against him arising from your allegations. Neither has Herod, who therefore has sent him back to us. Obviously this man has done nothing to deserve death. Therefore I mean to release him, once I have taught him a lesson." The whole crowd cried out, "Away with this man, release Barabbas for us." Pilate addressed them again, for he wanted Jesus to be the one he released. But they shouted back, "Crucify him, crucify him." He said to them for the third time, "What wrong is this man guilty of? I have not discovered anything about him deserving the death penalty. I will therefore chastise him and release him." But they demanded with loud cries that he be crucified, and their shouts increased in violence. Pilate then decreed that what they demanded should be done. He released the one they asked for, who had been thrown in prison for insurrection and murder, and delivered Jesus up to their wishes. A great crowd of people followed him, including women who beat their breasts and lamented over him. Two others were crucified along with him. When they came to Skull Place, as it was called, they crucified him there and the criminals as well, one on his right and the other on his left. The people stood there watching, and the leaders kept jeering at him, saying, "He saved others, let him save himself, if he is the Messiah of God, the Chosen One." The soldiers also made fun of him, coming forward to offer him their sour wine, and saying, "If you are the King of the Jews, save yourself." There was an inscription over his head, "This is the King of the Jews." Around midday, and darkness came over the whole land, until mid-afternoon with an eclipse of the sun. The curtain in the sanctuary was torn in two. Jesus uttered a loud cry and said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." After this, he expired. The centurion, upon seeing what had happened, gave glory to God by saying, "Surely this was the Son of God." After the crowd assembled for this spectacle witnessed what had happened, they returned beating their breasts. All his friends and the women who had accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, watching everything.
The sixth Sunday of Lent, which was formerly known as Palm Sunday, is now officially entitled Palm Sunday of the Passion of Christ. So runs its full title, showing, writes a liturgist, that the liturgy of the day will unite two commemorations, that of the entrance of Jesus into Jerusalem and that of his Passion. The origin of Palm Sunday is explained in The Liturgical Year.
The diary of Egeria the Pilgrim tells us that at the beginning of the 5th century, the Christians of Jerusalem used to gather in the early afternoon on the Mount of Olives for a lengthy liturgy of the Word. Then, toward evening, they would go in procession into Jerusalem, carrying palm branches or olive branches. This rite was soon esteemed and imitated in other churches of the East. As for its spread in the West, the name Palm Sunday occurs in Spain and Gaul around 600, but there's no procession with the palms. In these countries, the Gospel for the Mass of the sixth Sunday of Lent was taken from John 12, which tells of the anointing at Bethany. But the passage continued on to the story of the entrance into Jerusalem. For this reason, the Sunday soon acquired the name of Palm Sunday, although there was as yet no special ceremony in commemoration of the event. The custom of blessing the palm branches is attested around the middle of the 8th century. Since palm and olive branches were obtainable only in southern countries, The custom was early introduced of blessing the green and blossoming branches of other trees, including beech branches. In Germany, it was usually branches of willows that already had their catkins.
And in medieval England, we hear, palms were often made from willow, box and yew. But willow is still used to this day. In Richard Mabie's Flora Britannica, we read, the Christian festival of Eastertide begins with Palm Sunday, when sprays of pussy willow or yew are sometimes used as substitutes for true palm. The pussy willow or sallow are vernacular names for the goat willow, the commonest and most widespread willows in Britain, and the earliest to flower. The catkins are put out before the leaves, silky, silver-grey buds. They used to be called goslings, writes Mabie, because their texture and colour were like newly hatched geese. And as children, we loved them. In his Prospect of Flowers, Andrew Young tells us that the sallow's catkins come a little later than those of the hazel, for, he writes,
the sallow, observant of the church's ritual, waits to provide palm for Palm Sunday. The sallow, or palm willow, grows anywhere, and early in March we may see in some sheltered spot, perhaps a hollow wood, as the first sign of spring, among willows at least, the satin shining palm. By the end of March these buds have opened, the catkins on the make, trees yellow with pollen. And through the leafless underwood, rich stains of sunny gold show where the sallows bloom.
So wrote John Clare in the early 19th century. And a 20th century comment seems to confirm the continuance of a long tradition.
I remember attending Sunday school on Palm Sunday and wearing a sprig of pussy willow, and my father was always told, you get your hair pulled if you don't wear a piece of palm on Palm Sunday.
But what was the significance of the palm? It gets its name from the Latin palma, palm of the hand, from the spread hand appearance of the tree. It's a symbol of resolution, overcoming calamity. It's said by Orientals to have sprung from the residue of the clay of which Adam was formed. But when someone talks about their palmy days, they're referring to prosperous or happy days, as those were to a victorious gladiator, to whom the Romans gave a branch of the palm tree as a reward for his prowess. From this too comes our expression to bear the palm, while to yield the palm of victory is to admit another's superiority in a given field. Here in Italy we have olive branches on Palm Sunday, and on that first Palm Sunday, the branches were of both palms and olives, for both trees grew in the area. In a poem by Robert Browning, The Patriot, its hero is greeted with roses and myrtle, which was sacred to Venus and a symbol of love. But the patriot of the poem is on his way to execution and is remembering with bitterness the acclamation of the populace a year earlier.
It was roses, roses all the way, with myrtle mixed in my path like mad. The house roofs seemed to heave and sway, the church spires flamed, such flags they had, a year ago on this very day. The air broke into a mist with bells, the old walls rocked with the crowd and cries. There's nobody on the housetops now, just a palsied few at the window set. For the best of the sight is all allow at the shambles' gate, or better yet, by the very scaffold's foot, I trow.
The shambles' gate was probably very near the place of execution. Shambles originally meaning a stall in a market where meat was sold, and later meaning a slaughterhouse. Jesus had the crowds always, on his day of triumph and on that of his death. And a scholar makes this reflection on the shouts of Hosanna.
In the song of the crowd of disciples, there's almost an answer to the angelic greeting in the hymn for the birth of Christ. The angels sang, "Glory to God in the highest and peace on earth to the men he loves." Now the disciples proclaim, "Peace in heaven and glory in the highest heavens."
And from the palms we come now to the Passion. Our Gospel today, in the short form, of which we've just heard a part, begins with the first words of chapter 23 of Luke's Gospel, with Jesus already being taken to Pilate. But the long version of the Gospel begins at the opening of the previous chapter, with the treason of Judas, the Last Supper, and the institution of the Eucharist. And then Jesus and the disciples go to the Mount of Olives, as usual, we read. Only when they get there, Jesus withdraws from them, after telling them to pray not to be put to the test. Luke writes that he was only about a stone's throw away, but it's as if he were thousands of miles away, totally alone. In all his life, he has never been so alone as at this moment. He prays for the cup to be taken from him, but then, "Nevertheless, let your will be done, not mine." In his poem, The Olive Garden, Rainer Maria Rilke imagines the agony of Jesus as he goes on, not just a little further, but upward.
And still he climbed, and through the grey leaves thrust, quite grey and lost in the grey olive lands, and laid his burning forehead full of dust, deep in the dustiness of burning hands. After all, this and this then was the end. Now I'm to go, while I'm going blind, and oh, why wilt thou have me still contend, thou art, whom I myself no longer find? No more I find thee, in myself no tone of thee, nor in the rest, nor in this stone. I can find thee no more. I am alone. I am alone with all that human fate I undertook through thee to mitigate. Thou who art not, oh shame too consummate. An angel came, those afterwards relate. Wherefore an angel? Oh, there came the night, and turned the leaves of trees indifferently, and the disciples stirred uneasily. Wherefore an angel? Oh, there came the night.
The night came indeed, and with it Judas and arrest, interrogation by Annas, Caiaphas, the Sanhedrin, Peter's denial, cockcrow. What a night! Where did he spend it? With the guards, presumably, who had their sport with him, mocking him, beating him, blindfolding him, and asking him, "Who hit you?" Jesus of a certainty had no sleep that night. The guards on duty would have seen to that. And a line from a poem about a street vagrant comes to mind. Where did last night's Christ lie down? Day breaks, and the chief priests and the elders and the scribes, who have had a night's sleep, meet in council and have Jesus brought to them. "Is he the Christ? Is he the Son of God?" is all they ask now. And his answer decides them. He must die, and so to Pilate. Of the four evangelists, only John reports the dialogue between Jesus and Pilate at any length. But they all quote the question, "Are you the King of the Jews?" And the answer, "It is you who say it." Because this was the ultimate indictment, his claim to be king. The real reason for the Sanhedrin's sentence of death was his claim to be Son of God, but Pilate would not have understood the gravity which such a blasphemy had in their eyes. So the reason was given a political slant. As Pilate does not yield immediately, the chief priests add that Jesus has been stirring up the people with his teaching, from Galilee, where he began, to this very place. Galilee, Herod's territory. So Pilate sends him to Herod, who sends him back. Pilate then offers to release Jesus instead of Barabbas. But by now the crowd has become a howling mob, and there is no turning back.
They demanded with loud cries that he be crucified, and their shouts increased in violence. Pilate then decreed that what they demanded should be done.
And it was. And to close these reflections, here are some lines from The Killing by Edwin Moore, said against the background of Luke's words. That was the day they killed the Son of God on a squat hilltop by Jerusalem. Zion was bare, her children from their maze sucked by the demon curiosity clean through the gates. The very halt and blind had somehow got themselves up the hill.
A great crowd of people followed him, including women who beat their breasts and lamented over him.
After the ceremonial preparation, the scourging, nailing against the wood, erection of the main trees with their burden, while from the hill rose an orchestral wailing, they were there at last, high up in the soft spring day. We watched the writhings, heard the moanings, saw the three heads turning on their separate axles like broken wheels left spinning. Round his head was loosely bound a crown of plaited thorn that hurt at random, stinging temple and brow as the pain swung into its envious circle.
The people stood there watching, and the leaders kept jeering at him. The soldiers also made fun of him.
Some who came to stare grew silent as they looked, indignant or sorry. But the hardened old and the hard-hearted young, although at odds from the first morning, cursed him with one curse, having prayed for a rabbi or an armed messiah, and found the Son of God. What use to them was a god or a son of God? Of what avail for purposes such as theirs? Beside the crossfoot, alone, four women stood and did not move all day. The sun revolved, the shadow wheeled.
And darkness came over the whole land. The curtain in the sanctuary was torn in two. Jesus uttered a loud cry and said, "Father, into your hands I commend my spirit." After he said this, he expired.
Death was slow and came so quietly they scarce could mark it.
After the crowd assembled for this spectacle witnessed what had happened, they returned beating their breasts. All his friends and the women who had accompanied him from Galilee were standing at a distance, watching everything.
I was a stranger, could not read these people or this outlandish deity. Did a god indeed in dying cross my life that day by chance, he on his road and I on mine?
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua. She'll be back again at this same time next week with the next edition of There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. In the meantime, let's join Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome, who brings us a bird's eye view of the past week in the Vatican. So, Joan, welcome back.
My goodness, here we are just on the cusp, if you will, of Palm Sunday and Holy Week, and where has the time gone? But of course, we say that every week. But it does feel like we see each other about once an hour But this was an interesting week. A couple of big events. Sunday, well, it was an important event, but not celebrated in a big way. Last Sunday, of course, was the third anniversary. It was the 13th of March and third anniversary of the election of Pope Francis. And it's kind of like, wow, really, 3 years already. So, of course, there were cheers this Sunday, the Pope speaking to the crowd for the Angelus from his study window, and huge cheers went up and people wishing him auguri, best wishes. I'm sure he received gifts, but he gave the faithful a gift last Sunday, because after his usual reflections on the Sunday Gospel and then reciting the Marian prayer, afterwards he said he had a gift for the faithful. It was a small pocket-sized Gospel of St. Luke, which he said has been called the Gospel of Mercy. I don't think I had ever realized that. Francis urged all of us to read it every day. He said, this way the mercy of the Father will dwell in your heart and bring it to everyone you meet. And then I thought it was very interesting. He always lets us know who is in St. Peter's Square distributing the books. They were distributed around the obelisk, and there were probably 10,000 of us who hadn't made it in time to go through security to get into the square, so we were in the Pius the 12th Square. Massive group. And going down the beginning of Via della Conciliazione. And the Pope, when he mentioned that it was several volunteers from the the Santa Marta Pediatric Dispensary in the Vatican, and also a number of grandparents. And he thanked them, by the way, for passing on the faith to their children. But then it was interesting. He's looking out the window, and his gaze came over to where all of us were standing in the square, and he said, "I see there's a very big group of people who didn't make it into St. Peter's Square." And he said, "But don't worry, the books will come your way." Well, they didn't quite make it. But anyway, that was his gift to us on Sunday. And by the way, I don't remember now if it was Sunday or Monday that it was announced. But anyway, this week it was announced that Pope Francis is going to make his debut on Instagram on March 19th, which of course will be the anniversary. That Saturday is the anniversary of the start of his pontificate. So he's going to have the handle Franciscus, and we will start to follow him in another one of the new social media. Monday was pretty quiet, except for an audience that the Holy Father had with Father Michael Anthony Perry, who's the Minister General of the Franciscan Order of Friars Minor. Then we moved to Tuesday.
The big day,
yes, because we kind of suspected this was coming, but still you wait for it to be official. The Holy Father had a consistory of cardinals in which he read the decrees for the canonizations of five people, one of whom was Blessed Mother Teresa Corsa of Calcutta. And the announcement of the dates of the beatifications also, and hers will be September 4th, which most people had kind of guessed because that she died on the 5th of September, 1997, and so this would be very close to her, obviously, to the anniversary of her death. But interestingly enough, in the fall, canonizations usually take place in the third week of October, that the third Sunday of October is always Mission Sunday, and there are canonizations then. But we also had four other names. Were Blessed Maria Elizabeth Hesselblad, of Sweden, and she founded a branch, the biggest so far, of the Brigittine Sisters. They have a beautiful place on Via Monserrato next to Piazza Farnese. And then we have Blessed Jose Gabriel del Rosario. He is known in Argentina as the Gaucho Priest. Oh, I did kind of slide over another very important name, actually. Blessed Stanislaw of Jesus and Mary, who founded the Marians of the Immaculate Conception. And I was telling readers of my blog, this is very special to me because Father Joe Roche, who has, I know, done things for Vatican Radio, he does a lot of commentaries, especially presentations on Divine Mercy for EWTN. And he is an officer, if you will, in the Order of the Marians. And I know a great number of them. So then we have the Gaucho Priest. And then lastly, and this is one a person who's fascinated me, Blessed Jose Luis Sanchez del Rio from Mexico. And if any of our listeners saw the 2012 movie For Greater Glory, he's really one of the main protagonists. He was a 14-year-old who was killed for his faith. This was the chronicle of the 1926-1929 Cristeros War in Mexico, where the people of Mexico were rebelling against their atheistic government. That was the big news Tuesday.
Then Wednesday was a regular day.
General audience, St. Peter's Square. A lot of the Pope's talk, he talked about mercy and compassion, and a lot of the Pope's talk actually focused on migrants and refugees, on the situation in the Middle East and so forth. And the Pope said at the audience that he wanted to see, and it pleased him when he saw leaders, especially in Europe, who open their hearts and their doors to the many migrants who, of course, are fleeing to European countries because of violence and poverty. And, I mean, as we are talking today, there's a big meeting in Brussels with the leaders of European countries, Turkey and so forth, talking about the migrant situation. And then the Pope spoke of our many brothers and sisters who are living a real and dramatic situation of exile, far from their homeland, with the ruins of their homes and fear still in their eyes, and even, unfortunately, the pain for the loss of their loved ones. He went on quite at length and in many off-the-cuff remarks about the very painful situation of these innocent men, women, and children who find doors closed to them when they attempt to go elsewhere. The Pope said, when they don't feel welcome, God, he said, doesn't forget the pain of those who are rejected, but it is easy to ask oneself, where is God? And then on another topic, the Pope, again at the audience on Wednesday, he offered words of solidarity for those in the Middle East suffering from the wars and violence that continue to affect the region. In particular, addressing people from the Middle East, he said, "The consolation of the Lord is near those who pass through the agonizing night of doubt, clinging and hoping for the dawn of the mercy of God, which the totality of the darkness and injustice will never be able to defeat." And he concluded his remarks to people from the Middle East by saying, "God bless you and protect you from evil."
That takes us to Thursday.
Yes, Thursday was the President of Portugal. The Holy Father received the President of Portugal, Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa, and did invite him to come to Fatima, to come to Portugal for the centenary of Fatima, which, of course, will be next year, 2017. So I have a feeling that the Pope will certainly be winging his way to Portugal for that event. And then another interesting meeting on Thursday, the Pope addressed the participants of the Harvard World Model United Nations, reminding them that the world's problems always have a human face. Now, this Model UN, it's a four-day international relations simulation promoted by Harvard University for high school students from around the world. And the Pope did talk to them about their experience of diversity as a remedy for the world's evils. Diversity is a word which, depending on how you define it, it can actually divide people or unite people. But the Pope is saying, look at this as a remedy for the world's evils. Behind every difficulty our world is facing, there are men and women, young and old, people just like you. There are families and individuals whose lives are shaped daily by struggles, who try to care for their children, provide not only for their future, but also the basic necessities of life. And he highlighted to these young people, the greatest benefit is your time together, your encounter. Here's the diversity, your encounter with people from around the world who represent not only our many contemporary challenges, but above all, the rich diversity of talents and potential of the human family. Also, by the way, yesterday the Vatican let us know that we do know the Pope has a book out called, in English anyway, Dear Pope Francis, and these are a whole bunch of questions by children that the Pope answered in the book, and there's some great drawings. So the Pope personally inscribed a copy of the book for the children at the Vatican-owned Bambino Gesù Children's Hospital. He wrote, "To all the children of the Children's Hospital, Child Jesus, and to those who lovingly provide care for them." And then the publishers of the book did give 500 copies, which is lovely. You know, so children and families can go home with a
special ordination on Saturday, isn't there?
You're right. A good friend of a lot of ours, the Holy Father, will ordain as a bishop, Monsignor Peter Wells. And he was named a month ago as the Apostolic Nuncio in Lesotho and Namibia in South Africa. And then also the Secretary, Monsignor Miguel Angel Ayuso Guiso, Secretary of the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue, is also being ordained a bishop in St. Peter's. So a big week, in addition to which we did learn about the Pope's itinerary, the first draft of the itinerary to Poland for World Youth Day in July. And we did learn, this is not a surprise really, that he will be going to Auschwitz. And I don't think that a Pope could visit Poland without going to Auschwitz. So,
well, thank you very much, Joan.
The wrap-up of the week's highlights.
You were listening there to Joan Lewis, EWTN's bureau chief here in Rome. That brings me up to time. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. This is Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.